As I indicated in the announcements, several years ago, I could have actually not predicted that I would have felt as positive as I do about the church today. And I know that there has been all kinds of rumors about whether we keep the Sabbath anymore, if we oppose the concept of the Trinity, if we'll keep Passover, if we believe in a paid ministry or cost-effective television, or understand the shortcomings of Protestantism. Just trying to summarize a lot of the critical things that have come to different people. But finally, we were at a point, I believe, that through a catharsis, they were ready to go for some growth. For the first time in some years, WGN is setting records of cost effectiveness. Back in the days, 30 years ago, in the heyday of TV, we would have, we were thinking if we could just get to $5 per response, that would, everybody in the industry said that would be fantastic. Now we're at under 10. Five programs have been under $10 a response. One was like $8.50. And when you figure inflation, that would be like in the old days, which weren't that long ago in one sense, 25, 30 years ago. That would be like having a cost per response of $2 or $2.50. Now, this is wonderful. Although that exceeded expectations. The Good News subscription rate is growing again, 6.5. That's about the highest percentage that we've ever seen. The income has bottomed out. It's moving up. Attendance also is bottomed out in February, and it's climbing again. And April will be very interesting. Number of money percentage for the gospel is the highest it's ever been. It's way higher than it's ever been. All of this has happened in the last 2 months. In Psalm 133, it says, how good and pleasant it is for people to dwell in unity. And we have unity that I've never seen. I saw some unity back after 1978-79 when Mr. Armstrong had his heart attack and he came back and he, quote-unquote, put the church back on track. And I remember there was a cleaning of the house as far as the theology department. I know that very well because I had all those guys as teachers. In some cases, good teachers, but they had a different agenda, pushing a different envelope. At any rate, things changed. And under Mr. Armstrong's tutelage, we had incredible growth. We became the number one religious program in the world. We had, for the good, the Plain Truth magazine became the highest subscribed magazine next to Reader's Digest. And Reader's Digest, they sold, they made money. We gave ours away. And so it was the largest mass circulation magazine in the world next to the other one. And it was incredible. I vividly remember that we were in 1984, 85, in on the refresher program, and it was being stated, we are getting inundated with so many visit requests. New York City got 100 visit requests in a single month. You can't get around everybody. You used to have to start meeting them in groups. And in Baltimore, there were visit requests of 200 on one particular month. Everybody was getting at least 30 and 40. This is what could happen. At that point, I thought, wow, something's got to give. We can't keep this up. We need more people. We need an army. And then Mr. Armstrong died. There was 100,000 people requesting Mystery of the Ages posthumously. And after that program, it went downhill. And then you get to the late 80s. Instead of $20 to $24 million budget, the leadership kept taking money away. And they had to lay people off. They had to reduce their planning and creativity. And finally, it was axed out altogether. And that seemed to be the agenda of the people that were running the organization. I didn't understand at the time, but I look back on it now, and time creates a different perspective. God did not like that, but God allowed it. And I think he allowed it to see what the people were made of that still understood the value of that, that still embraced, not that he was perfect, but the principles that Mr. Armstrong talked about that were tried and proven for 50 years. From the early days of 1930s when he had the public campaigns and the broadcast of media reach and then personal contact in church, and said that we had a dual commission, as we see in Matthew 28, to preach the gospel to the world and then take care of the flock. Not just take care of the flock, not just worry only about ourselves. As he said so many times, we weren't called for our own salvation. We were called to be part of a work and to help. In fact, though, it's a blessing to our own salvation because we grow to the extent that our hearts are in the work. When we're mentally involved, when we're praying about it, and when we can help it. And I think that we can help in ways that we didn't even dream of. It's already happening in some areas. You never know. Crisis creates opportunity. In South Africa, somebody stepped up to the plate, and now he's an ordained person, and he's not a spring chicken. He's not green, as it were. But he's managing the country, and he's full-time minister. There are people that have the opportunity to be able to do things, and I'll get into that a little bit later. But that has to happen to sustain growth, because what if we get famous again? WGN generates 1,000, sometimes 1,300 responses in a single weekend, plus several more, maybe 100 in Canada. And that's just one station. We would get 8,000, 10,000 when we were number one in the market, and that was with hundreds of stations. And so I just see that we are moving in that direction. And I'm the kind of guy that says, if you show me a big machine like one of these Gravely mowers or whatever, you know. Remember, some people are impressed with machinery like that. I remember when I was 15, a neighbor wanted me to mow his huge area, and you could do it with one of these monster machines. My first question was, how do you turn it off? You know, I don't want this thing to get out of control. That's just my nature. And I don't want to see this get turned off, growth in the church. But it's, how can we harness it? How do we stay ahead of the curve? How can we stay on top of it and manage it? And so there are things that we need to be thinking about. Because when you have this kind of synergy and this kind of unity, God always blesses the unity. He always does. He did in the early 80s. That was a remarkable time for the church. And he did for a very short window in the 1970s. And he clearly did that in the 50s and 60s. Those weren't perfect years. Not by any stretch of the imagination. That we had more solidarity in the leadership in those decades, and the church grew. God responds to that. That's just like God, when somebody's baptized and they are repented of all sin, God's Spirit can dwell in that individual. And He can bless. It's just a law of spiritual activity that God is going to bless unity. And so my question, and actually the title of my sermon is, what does spiritual unity in the church mean to you? God will bless this unity, but what does that unity mean to you? I think that if your heart's in the work, in whatever position you find yourself, you're going to be more involved in the future and busier, and you will grow. And that's not a bad thing, to even being busy, because it is a stepping stone of faith to be working and serving more of humanity. And we grow as a result. And we need to take on the challenges even down the road in the future. I can remember one man said that we had a pastor in Pennsylvania in 74. And when he got there, they were all angry. They were agitated. It wasn't that long afterwards that two out of three left. He said a year later, there were still 600 people in that congregation. Where did they come from? God will bless. I think sometimes He holds things back until all dysfunction is worked out of the circumstance, and God says, I can now bring people in. I can bless. Because there's harmony, there's peace, there's happening, there's the fruits of God's Spirit. And He can do that when there's unification in the leadership. And He can do that when it's extant throughout the ministry. This is how to happen. And it will happen if the leadership and if the ministry is blunt, honest about themselves and can read Psalm 39, verse 5, and the people as well that are part of what's going on, Psalm 39, verse 5, and understand this. David wrote, "Behold, you have made my days as a handbreadth, and my ages as nothing before you. Truly, every man in his best state is altogether vanity." Vanity. Of ourselves, without God's Spirit, you know, we can be, you know, wonderfully made, the creations of God, in the image of God. But we're nothing. Just like blades of grass. They wither very quickly. James talks about that, and he talks about that, quoting Isaiah. And so, of ourselves, we're nothing. John 15, verse 5 says that. There's no place in God's ministry to become a strutting peacock or I'm so indispensable. And over many, many years, there have been people that have done that. There have been at least three that I can think of that said, "Well, I built the work." I was in Mr. Armstrong's home one time, and I said, "Did you ever envision that it would be as big as it was worldwide?" And he believed in looking ahead and planning regionally and so on. And just very quickly says, "Oh, no, I didn't. You know, I could see growth, but I never expected us in the beginning to be a worldwide organization." You know, and the fact that he said on another occasion, again, not that he was perfect, but I don't know anybody with a better spiritual batting average, and he was in the saddle for 55 years. He said a lot of things, but, you know, we grow to the extent that our heart's in the work. And he said, I would like to think that I had something to do with the development of things, but he says, I do not take credit for that. There was remember the person that performed our marriage said one time when Mr. Armstrong came through in Pittsburgh, "And now I will introduce you the head of the work, Mr. Armstrong." And he got up and he just went ballistic. He says, "I'm not the head of the work. Christ is. I'm a puny human being." We can't ever forget that our power and our strength come from God, that He gets the credit for anything, and that if we get in the way, then we could roadblock a future growth. There's no need for that. In Isaiah 55 and verse 10, I don't worry about us getting in the way. Just worry about what God will do with us if we get in the way, because He'll say, "I'll raise stones, I'll get other people. Anybody's replaceable." Isaiah 55 and verse 10 and 11. "As the rain comes down, the snow from heaven returns not there, but waters the earth and makes it, you know, bloom the flowers and the grass brings forth and limbs of trees, buds, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater. So shall my word be that goes forth out of my mouth, and it shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing wherein I send it." So if God says there will not be a work, there won't be. He says if my church endures to the end, it will. He says if I will do a great work at the end time, and you again go to nations and kings and people, for example, in Revelation 10 and 11, then it will happen. According to Gamaliel, and this is true for any organization, it's true for us, if God be behind it, nothing can stop it. The gates of the grave, nothing. But if God is not in favor of it, it will come to nothing. I said that on March 11th when I gave my last sermon and worldwide. And I knew it was my last because they made it clear to me that it was going to be my last. And even then, back then, I hung in there as long as I could because I was still allowed, even though it was unpopular, to preach true doctrine. Isaiah 46, verses 9 and 10. Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. "Remember the former things of old? For I am God," God says, "and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like Him, declaring the end from the beginning, and the ancient times, the things that are yet done, saying, My counsel shall stand, I shall do my pleasure, and He will do His work." Now, if I forget what Psalm 39:5 says and all, He'll probably say, "Kid, I'm going to do it, and you're not part of it. He doesn't need me. I need him. But if all of us are willing to humble ourselves and to accept reality of who we are and ask God to give the Spirit and the help, then the work gets done. And God gets the credit. And we have the satisfaction doing that. And it can be very gratifying. You can feel good about helping somebody or turning somebody's life around. One area that is going to be important is with these public Bible lectures. I don't know if we'll have 3 people or 10 or 20. I can tell you that as a rule, the wackiest people try to dominate the speaker afterwards. I remember giving a public Bible lecture a long time ago, and somebody came up to me and said, "Well, that was really good. Boy, I'm down with this. I mean, you really connected here. Now, based on your knowledge and your special insight, and about seem to know the prophecies really well, do you think I should move all my investments into penny stocks, or should I dump that and get into real estate now? I know that gold is going up." And I says, "Look, I don't know anything about that." "No, no, no, no. I'm with you, man. I'm with you. You know about these things. I know that you know about these things." I'm looking around, "Help, you know, I've been tackled, I've been sacked." And that's where the people that are more balanced, where you guys come in, and you talk to them and engage them, and you answer their questions. And many of them will have questions. And that is really important. I remember Dean Wilson saying that about the lectures they had in Canada. And I remember being in the Las Vegas church and other places. And there was one person in Las Vegas that says, "You know, this is really interesting. I want to, I'm so impressed with this," talking to the speaker. "I want to have a meeting where I have you present and then a Catholic priest and a Jewish rabbi. And I'm going to tape record this. This could be a potential program, you know, and debate these things." Well, it just doesn't. No, you know. It doesn't work. So, we have to... That will be an upcoming challenge, is for us to be responsive, to be able to help. And then always asking for God's blessing on whatever it is that we do. The in the home office, it's not just some kind of a show, but different ones have said that many times they'll come, maybe every day, over to Denny Luker's office, and they'll draw a curtain. They'll get on their knees. They might pray for a long time about different things, about their far-reaching decisions. And I think, not that that maybe hasn't happened before, but not recently that anybody can think of. That's, why not? Why not? If you want God to be directing things, why not ask for His help? And so, ask for a good quality response. And God is adding co-workers to the effort, and we can be praying about that. And if their hearts are in the work, they're going to have questions, and we're going to need to be able to answer them. That's very, very important. People like Moses and David, when he began, they didn't think they were indispensable. They knew the value of prayer, and they went to God. One of the most inspiring cases I can think of is when King Jehoshaphat of Judah was realizing that his nation was in dire straits. It had not been as close to God as it needed to be. And over in 2 Chronicles 20, we can read where there were some serious issues. In 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and verse 1. Here are the three huge armies were converging on Judah. And they could have tried to hole up behind the walls of the city, or maybe try to make a run for it to Ammon or somewhere across the Jordan River. Instead, even though Jehoshaphat knew the nation was not as zealous for God, it says in verse 1, "It came to pass after this, the children of Moab, Ammon, and with them the Ammonites," that's three major nations, "their armies came against Jehoshaphat to battle. And someone came and told Jehoshaphat, saying, 'There comes a great multitude from you, from beyond the sea, on this side Syria.' And Jehoshaphat feared. We would fear as well if we were in his shoes. And he set himself to seek the Lord and proclaimed a fast throughout all of Judah. And more than ever, I see the leadership as a fasting leadership. And Judah gathered themselves together to ask help of the Lord. Even out of all the cities of Judah, they came to seek the Lord. And Jehoshaphat stood in the congregation of Judah and Jerusalem in the house of the Lord and before the new court. And he said, O Lord of God, of our fathers, are you not the God in heaven that rules over the kingdoms of the heathen? And he was reminding them. It was a clever prayer. Well, you know, these guys are not keeping your law. Yeah, we're not doing as well as we should, but these guys are the heathens. And in pagan, in your hand is there not the power and the might, so that none is able to withstand you? No, Jehoshaphat had the faith. And whether he felt like walking the tightrope wire over Niagara Falls or not, he was on the chopping block. It was do or die, now or never. Are you not our God who did drive out the inhabitants of this land before the people of Israel and gave it to the seed of Abraham, your friend, forever? I mean, you have intervened before. This is nothing new for you. If you're the same God as now as you were then, Malachi 3:6 and Hebrews 13:8 says, you know, yesterday and today and forever, the Christ does not change, and God does not change. Verse 8, and they dwelt therein, and they built you a sanctuary in your name, saying, if when evil comes upon us as a sword or judgment or pestilence or famine, we stand before this house and in your presence and cry in our affliction, then you will help us and hear us. And now, look, the children of Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, whom you would not let Israel invade. You know, we did our part of the bargain. When they came out of the land of Egypt, and when they turned from them and destroyed them not, I say, behold, how they reward us to come to cast it out of the possession. O Lord our God, will you not judge them? For we have no might against this great company that comes against us. Neither know we what to do, but our eyes are upon you. When back in December, in January, Victor Cuba talked about what a bleak time it was for him. He's a very, very passive person. I mean, he doesn't like conflict. Nobody likes conflict. But he said he felt so alone. He was the only one left in ministerial services. And there was one resignation every day, and there were 18 on one day, and it just went on and on. And it was very discouraging. And he didn't have the complete information. And Denny Luker said, looks like all Florida's gone. They didn't know the two out of three stayed. And all Texas gone. Well, 500 stayed. But it was serious. We didn't know about the Caribbean. Didn't know about South Africa. Didn't know if Nigeria was all there or not. And a lot of other doubts in other places. And they were on their knees a lot during this time. You know, we and our little ones, so to speak, and it says Judah, verse 13, stood before the Lord with the little ones, their wives and their children. It was just a time to wear a hole in the rug with one's knees and just say, please, give us wisdom, help us to have the people we need, help us to see what to do. And things turned. And they're not as stressed. They're actually able to take some time off now because things bottomed out by February, and March and April improved, and the attitude within the ministry is electric. It's terrific. But, I mean, these things are written for our examples. Every crisis that we've ever faced, we can find a precedent in the Old Testament. I don't have time to enumerate all of them, but you can go back and find precedents where the other people faced the same or different circumstances, had the same level of anxiety or intensity. It was a real trial. You still do the same things and ask for God's help. And there are times like that. You do the best you can. You work as if it all depends on you, and then you trust God as if it all depends on Him. Mr. Armstrong did that over and over again. In Exodus 14, when the Israelites were ready to cross the Red Sea, the people didn't have any faith and they were scared. They were in a box canyon with Pharaoh's army coming in the rear and walls on two sides, and the only way of escape was across the salt water. And it made no sense with no boats or anything. In verse 13, Moses said to the people, fear you not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he shall show you this day. You know, I used to get frustrated over the last few years. I didn't say much to anybody because I didn't think it was right. But when I saw the disunity and certain people doing certain things, instead, I realized I had to go to God. And you know the prayer I gave? I said, God, from what I understand, this is not the way it should be. And I'm holding you responsible for it. This is your church. It's got your name on it. And you got to do something about it. Because I can't. I'm one of these helpless people. I can't. And he, you know what? He didn't do it according to my timetable. And seldom does that happen. But when he does it, it takes your breath away. And when he does it, you see results. You see fruits. Sooner or later, it becomes obvious. In verse 14, the Lord shall fight for you and you shall hold your peace. Now, because these things didn't happen, say, as soon as I wanted it to or other people, didn't mean that that was wasted time. Because all the while, God was testing all of us. And in the ministry, I want to see what you do. Now, what if I do this? What if I add these weights? What if I give you this stress? Now, what are you going to do? And how about these other stresses? Let's see. And you can't say, oh, please give me an easier way out, because this may be pabulum compared to trials down the road when we have unity internally and persecution on the outside. You know, it says, he that endures the same shall, that endures to the end shall be saved. When I first came in, I thought, well, this is such exciting knowledge. Everybody's really going to pull in the same direction. Why, it's not that big of a deal to hang in there till the end. Well, I didn't know. It was. But the way to success is always the same. Being close to God, humbling oneself, fasting occasionally, and just asking for God to do what we know that we can't do on our own. It has to be a work of God. He doesn't lift a finger unless we acknowledge that and ask for his help. It says in 2 Chronicles 7:14, if my people will humble themselves, then I will hear from the heavens. That's the way God thinks. So who's going to help to fulfill the commission? I've already quoted the scripture and I went long in the announcement, so I have to move along here in the message, even though it's kind of a continuation. There are some who can't, yet they do. There are those that think they can, and they don't accomplish anything. And Deuteronomy 1 and verse 6 is an interesting concept. It's actually a part of the theme of the sermon. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 6, this was God speaking to the Israelites. They had been in Mount Horeb, that area, for about a year. After languishing and wandering around for many, many years in the desert. And so, finally, God said to them, it says, the Lord our God spoke unto us in Horeb, saying, you have dwelt long enough in this mount. Turn you and take your journey, and go on to the mount of the Amorites, and unto the places nigh there unto, in the plain, in the hills, in the vale, in the south, and by the seaside, to the land of the Canaanites. And so it's time to move on. That's what was given to the Israelites, and it's given to God's church. You know, inactivity can be an unscriptural comfort zone. And God's people should be making forward progress all the time. We've idled in neutral. We haven't had much new activity in the past. And now we've got the vehicles in motion again on a number of levels to be able to design to reach a lot of people and to fulfill the calling that God had wanted us to. And if you notice in the Bible, a number of people had to move out of their comfort zones. Abraham, for example, at age 75, had to leave the area of Shinar in the east and come to an area that he was unfamiliar with in Canaan. He was well established back where he was, well respected, successful, wealthy, but God blessed him, but asked him to move out of that comfort zone. Moses, the same thing. Lot, Jehoshaphat, any number of people that God has worked with even the disciples, had to move out of a comfort zone, had to be move forging ahead. Julius Caesar set an unusual example when his army landed in Britain, and he then allowed them to look back over the cliffs of Dover, and the men were surprised to see all their ships were on fire. And his point was, there's no turning back. You know, we have a job to do. And I think we of all people understand that we understand the scripture in Luke 9:62. No man having put his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. And we're supposed to seek the kingdom of God first, and the things, our needs, and everything else comes after, and God will add to us. There's no retreating from the calling that we have. Not that anybody was wondering about it. But what is the worst enemy of the church, do you think? What is it that could perhaps be a threat to that calling more than anything else? Is it heresy? Is it liberalism? Paganism? Gnosticism? What could be the most dangerous enemy of the church? When you read in Revelation 3 about the Laodicean mindset, how about complacency? Idling and neutral, not getting anywhere. We grow to the extent that we're moving forward. Kind of like the Australian coat of arms. And the coat of arms that country has is the kangaroo. And it's not because kangaroos are popular and live in Australia. It's because they have three toes and they are great at moving forward. They lose their balance if they try to go backward. They can't do it. They flop over. Kangaroos move forward. And like kangaroos, the work is most balanced when it's moving forward. It gets down to what can we do? I think of the public Bible lectures. I think of people that are writing articles and never dreamed that they would. I know of one deacon that was asked to write a number of them. What if you wanted to do that? Maybe you wouldn't have the perfect wording for the entire article, but it might be a fantastic idea. I know that the ministry is stretched thin and a lot of people are trying to juggle churches and write and so forth. Why couldn't, and this is what I ask, why couldn't brethren help with that? A few do, but others, you at any age have the capacity to be able to make a contribution like that. And if it's not perfect, it might be a perfect idea that others can revamp. Maybe it'd run in the magazine. It would have your name, this written by you and Scott Ashley or somebody else. But people can make a difference. People that have been in the church for 30 or 40 years, and you have, many of you, and others for less time but have taken it seriously or can, are in a position where you know a lot. And you should give yourself credit for that. And you could answer a lot of questions. If we have 200 visit requests in 1 month, or even 70 in 1 month, I can tell you that there's no way that I can get around. Even Miami, it takes an act of Congress to cross that city on certain hours of the day. It's huge. It makes this place look like a very small city. That's wonderful, because bigger is not better. But there are times when people are going to have to do more. We have people that volunteer for camps. We have people that have it set up in the hall, and that's good. But as far as frontline, being able to explain things, visit, share the hope that you have in yourself and all, I really believe that you can do that. I think that I should be able to shut my eyes and just point to anybody and say, can you go over and visit so-and-so, or answer their questions, or here after church, or whatever, because you've been around and you understand, and you can make a difference, and you can help. I know what it's like to do that, and it can be exhilarating. It's fun to talk about the plan of salvation, or tell somebody that just because their loved ones died, doesn't mean that's the end of it. Or that they're somehow up in heaven, they're looking down on us. Well, you know, is that so wonderful? Well, they're trying to put a spin on a difficult situation. And you can say, I've got concrete information that says something far better than that's going to happen. And you're able to explain these things. We need more people to speak. It's not for everybody, but we certainly will down the road. And when you prepare, you know, when you build it, you know, the people come, so to speak, a takeoff of that movie came out. But before that could happen, you know, and things have languished and idled and neutral to some extent, although people have grown individually. These are not wasted years, the last quarter of a century. But you have to go back to 1985 when things were on the upswing. And so now, with that happening, you know, are we doing what we can internally to be close to God, asking God to help magnify our efforts, help me, help anybody, my friend, whatever, to make a bigger contribution, a frontline contribution, to be able to work with other people? I know we can do work with things, but what about other people? When Andrew Carnegie looked at his life, he'd given away over $350 million. That's, who knows what that was worth in today's money. He made the observation the average person puts in 25% of his energy and ability into his work. He said the world salutes anyone that could invest 50% of their effort, potential energy into whatever they're doing. And he says for the few that put in 100%, the world will stand on its head. I've seen people give standing ovations to pianists that would practice 7 hours a day to play concert piano. What about people that are professional in a sense, and I can use that word in the right way, professional Christians? They know what life's all about. They know why they're alive. They know where they're going. They know where the church is going. They know what the commissions are. They understand, believe, and invest in the mission statement. And they expect to get out of life what they put into life, and they expect solid prayers and answers to things that they come to God with for themselves, their relatives, and other people, and for God's work, and that religion is real. You know, that's 100%. There's no telling what kind of synergy happens. This is not some rah-rah sales job. This is the way God's Spirit works. When I look at the London Daily Telegraph, I think, yeah, of course, God is able to bless that and put us on the front page there. Now, this just because this is on the backside of the media, it says, what's new in media? And I'm just staggered at some of these statistics. People have watched YouTube, that's the video of the telecast since the beginning of the year, 1.6 million people. That's in addition to whatever people see on a Sunday morning. Clicks to our website generated by email campaigns where, oh yeah, I'd like to download a booklet or I'd like to see this. 552,000 clicks. And people are able to go to Apple Bookstore and download booklets for free. 66,000 times that's happened. It's hard for us to really know who all is listening and watching, but we know that it's increasing. We see that constantly. And it takes a while to build up a TV audience. But we've done that. We started out from scratch last August. We're not even in it a year. And we're getting a good cost per response, best in the history of the work. I can remember critics even a year ago, 2 years ago, talking about the foolishness of television and how it would be so prohibitively expensive and that if we dumped it in TV, we just wouldn't have anything for the ministry or whatever. Well, if we had to choose, let's put it in television. I can wash the windows still. I could pick up papers. I'll do whatever if it means helping to get a message out to the world, turning the world around. The world may or may not respond, but God said He would finish a work. And there's something else that I think is worth considering. It's over in Revelation 10. This is, I remember Gerald Waterhouse trying to make sense out of this. And he says, this is just before the emergence of the two witnesses. In Revelation 10, verse 4, he talks about the seven thunders here. And then he says, I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, write them not. And the angel which I, this is verse 5, which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven. And they swore by him that lives forever and ever, who created heaven and the things therein on the earth and the things there are in the sea, and that there should be time no longer. In other translations, no further delay. And going on, but in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished, as he declares to his servants the prophets. And what else does he declare to his servants the prophets? Amos 3 verse 7, surely I will do nothing except I declare it first through them, or give them the understanding of prophecy. Verse 8, and the voice which I heard from heaven spoke to me, saying, again, go and take the little book which is opened from the hand of the angel which stands upon the sea and upon the earth. I went to the angel and I said, give me that little book. And he said to me, take it, eat it. It shall make you bitter in your belly. I don't know what that means. I don't know if it means difficult end time trials. I've heard it speculated. I don't pretend to know. But I want to focus on a few other things. Verse 11, then he said again to me, you must prophesy, which simply means to speak forth, again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings. The framework that Mr. Waterhouse used to describe it was that was Mr. Armstrong coming back from near death, heart attack, and he did go to kings and leaders. That may be a total and a complete and a final fulfillment. But just in case, if we can have the kind of unity that we've never had before, and match or exceed what we had in the 1980s, surely we will be going before millions of people. It will change. We will see some exciting growth. And it might mean kings and priests, kings and tongues again. Time will tell. But this comes just before the emergence of the Great Tribulation, the two witnesses, and the beast power flexing its might. And so it suggests a mighty work could be on the verge of happening and a very short work. This is a time to have a sense of urgency. It's not a time to be idling and neutral. It's not a time to be complacent. The biggest enemy of the church. We, at any age, at any background, can be yielded to God to do more individually and all of us collectively. And so while it just may seem to be us here, we're on the verge of more growth. We're on the verge of turning it around. This is a nice attendance here, but we're going to see more activity. And we need to be ready for it. And what I ask us, and I'll do that in Tampa, it's wonderful to come. We can socialize, and there's everything right with that. But let's not just think of this as our own little group. When new people come, we want to be sincerely friendly. We want to make them feel welcome. We want to include them if they want to be included, and give them the opportunity to live up to whatever God wants them to do. And so it's not just us and ourselves. We're part of a team. We're part of something much, much bigger than ourselves. It's a great purpose to have. So what does church unity mean for you when the leadership is solid and the ministry is more together? It means more work for all of us. It means more to pray about, more to be involved and caring with. It means receiving information like this when this is just I just only read some of the statistics that are all good growth indicators. It's part of what we were called to do. And it's very, very important that we live up to the calling that God has given us. What others do is up to them. It's between them and God. I can't be their judge. But I just know that when we have success and unity, that everything else feeds off of that. So let's be glad for what can happen. Be sure to be reading information like this and watch the telecast. And that way you'll be more inclined to pray for its success. And it can be improved. And the people involved with it are open to suggestions. And they're excited. It's a fun time. It's great to get results. We're moving into another era. And it's not accidental that things have unfolded now the way I couldn't have known that. It takes perspective. It takes time looking back to see these things unfold. But let's live up to the calling that God has given us, and let's be excited to be about our Father's business.